Hi there and welcome to Stock Club, a podcast brought to you by My Wall Street. This week we've another fantastic interview for you guys to listen into. Sean Keyes is the finance correspondent with The Currency, a renowned Irish publisher that focuses on the world of business, finance and economics. Sean himself is a specialist in equity research and writes regularly about both the Irish and international stock markets, giving us in-depth profiles of major companies and sectors. A few weeks ago, Emmett sat down with Sean to chat about the current state of the market. They covered topics like Sean's recent findings on taking opportunities when the market seems like it's at its worst, what Sean's best and worst investing mistakes have been, and if he would buy, sell, or hold Bitcoin at the moment. Stock Club will return to normal service next week. We'll see you then.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Sean Keyes, best-selling author, editor, and speaker, and above all, finance correspondent for The Currency. Welcome to Stock Club.
Thank you for having me.
Sean, can you start by telling me a little bit about your career to date, both academic and professional?
Yes, so I did economics at university, didn't know what I was going to do with it. I wasn't too stressed because I thought that people get jobs out of economics somehow. But I wasn't very career focused either. Didn't go straight into an investment bank. Did my master's in economics at UCD then, and I had this vague thought that I enjoyed writing and I was quite good at it, I thought. And I had this qualification in economics and I was interested in it. So I thought, okay, I will be a financial journalist. And that was as far as my plans had gone. So, right, had to put my plan into action, went to London, got a job at Moneyweek, which is a financial publication over there, aimed at like ordinary investors, telling them like the latest ideas and the latest investment trends and things like that. Moneyweek then had a sideline in investment newsletters. So they would sort of upsell Moneyweek subscribers onto this an investment strategy. So the strategy would be like, you know, invest in small caps, R&D, mining companies, commodities, whatever it might be. Each one would be distinct and it would show an ordinary person from start to finish how you invest in this theme, and it would hold your hand, sort of sell the reader on the investment, do all the analysis, and then have a portfolio of buys, sells, and holds at the end of it. So a little mini miniature fund that was delivered by printed email and by email. So I did that for a few years. Then I made the leap into actually running one of those newsletters where I was sort of the regulated and responsible person for the investment advice. That was really fun and that was kind of a bit unexpected. I found myself as like a sort of a miniature fund manager. I had like 7,000 subscribers. The thing was focused on small caps initially, and then it was like technology stocks. We pivoted into technology stocks and then later on. But that was great fun. Did that for a few years. And then I'd been in London at that point for kind of 8-9 years. Felt the owl, tug of the heartstrings, thought it was time to come home back to Ireland. I was working remotely from Ireland for a while and I had a chance encounter with Tom Lyons. I met him. And then conversation developed and I was very pleased to start with The Currency when it launched in the September, October of 2019. And that's what I've been doing ever since. So my title is finance correspondent. Don't just cover finance, but I cover the more technical side of business coverage. I do, the financial system and macroeconomics, and I do company financials and company valuations and things of that nature. And I also have an investment email, which I think you say you've read, Emmett, before.
Yeah, that's right. I've been repeatedly impressed with your weekly email to the currency subscribers on matters ranging from a grand theory of why crypto is going down right through to what would have to happen for Tesla to be worth $1.2 trillion, which you can imagine caught my attention. But it was one particular piece, Sean, at the start of August called Don't Let Fear Mess Up Your Returns that prompted me to ask you to join me here today. And in the piece, you said that typically people sell their stocks when things are at their scariest and tend to wait until things look a bit safer before buying back in, or people put cash into the market when it feels safe and take it out when it feels risky, which is another way of saying buying high and selling low. And then you went on to discuss an almost unheard of paper, well, to me anyway, from University of Nebraska Lincoln, written by Friesen and Sapp in September 07. Can you discuss the findings of that paper, Sean?
Yeah, so they were looking at professional investors, not even ordinary investors. And they were comparing the actual cash returns that investors generated investing in funds with the fund's sort of headline returns. And the difference between those two numbers being accounted for by when the investors were in the fund and not in the fund, when they decided to pull cash in and that cash in and cash out. And professional investors do the same thing that ordinary people are warned not to do, which is they try to time the market. They look at the economic weather and they say, aha, I have in my wisdom decided that this is a bad time to be invested in these stocks, let's say, and I'm going to decide not to, I'm going to pull my cash out and we'll get back in at a better time for us. So yeah, systematically they found that this is a really, really bad idea. It dragged down returns by, I think it was like 1 or 1.5, maybe 2% per year, something like that, which, you know, in the context of your typical returns is enormous, and obviously when you start compounding it out over a long period of time, it's just this huge dent in your what you end up with. And yeah, it was sort of striking because, you know, I think you think of market timing as this like a sin of retail investors, maybe, you know, like that people are maybe a little bit naive and, you know, they buy stocks when the lads at the barbecue are saying, oh, you know, the market's doing great now, it's a good time to get in the market. And then that they sell stocks when the RT news is all about market, you know, showing market crashes. And so that they're, you know, obviously buying at the wrong time and selling at the wrong time. So you think, yeah, I don't know. Intuitively, I thought of it as a retail investment phenomenon. Sure, it is a retail investment phenomenon, but you had even these pros who all have CFAs and they've been doing it all their life and really should know better. And even these guys are making the same mistake to quite a serious extent.
Yeah, so effectively market timing doesn't work in the sense that it doesn't improve performance.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't improve performance because like it doesn't improve performance for, as I said in the piece, it's sort of two things that's put in there. It doesn't improve performance. It doesn't help you like get ahead of the index or the market because the market is forward looking and the price that's in the market now has already incorporated all of the fear or all of the excitement and greed that you might be hearing about or thinking about. That's already baked in, and the market price is looking at the earnings in future. So, like, you're just realistically not going to have an edge over the market's estimation of future incomes of the present value of future earnings, future cash flows. So, like, that's why you're not going to get ahead of it. And then the reason that's even worse than that, the reason that you'll probably fall behind it, is because even though the market goes up and down and it sort of seems sort of random. The market does go up and down in a sort of random pattern, but what it also does is it kind of in the long term, it does steadily grow. It's got a kind of a gentle tailwind behind it at all times of depending on exactly where and when you're talking about, but it's, you know, in the mid single digits percentages. So for any minute that you're, or any day that you decide is not a good time to be invested in the market, that's the day that you're not getting that tailwind.
I love that concept. I really do love that concept. And it's kind of underpins the approach I've always taken as a stock investor. And to quote something you wrote, even if the market seems like it's crashing, you have no reliable way of knowing whether worse is ahead. And the concept, Sean, that I love that you've introduced me to is that there's this constant gentle tailwind. It's a nice way of expressing the long-term, I suppose, long-term view. So as stock investors, or at least the way I invest, is going in and staying in for as very long as possible is a way of removing the variable, which is market timing. Should I get in? Should I get out? That simple question can distract an individual or a professional fund manager to the point of really eroding long-term returns.
Yeah, and I think like that tailwind thing, like it's actually linked to the sort of your stresses and your fears as an investor. Like the reason the market gives you 4, 5, 6, 7, 8% per year is because it's so volatile. And it's that volatility, like it's genuinely, you know, unpleasant as an investor to have to be dealing with it. You know, there's a psychological cost in it, and which is obviously why people try to time the market. And then there's also just a kind of a practical cost, which is that, you know, you can't plan your life very well because you don't know what your portfolio is not going to be worth next year. But like, so the greater the stress, the greater the volatility and the heartburn and the uncertainty, the stronger the tailwind, and they're intrinsically related. So an asset that doesn't give you much heartburn and gives you more certainty, that gives you less of a tailwind. An asset that's really volatile, really scary, that gives you more of a tailwind.
You said that rebalancing your portfolio periodically is a good idea. I'm not too sure, as it usually results in individuals punishing their returns by selling some of their big winners, which, you know, have a tendency to continue winning. Are you aware of any studies on the effect on returns by rebalancing?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you're right, Emmett, that it does lower your returns, because that's almost sort of what it's meant to do. Because if you think about it, like when you, let's say you start out, you're like, I want to take so much, only this much risk and no more. So I want to have half of my portfolio in safe stuff like bonds and half of it stocks. And because stocks typically tend to go up more and faster than bonds, what you'll end up with in future is in 5 years time is that your 50-50 portfolio has turned into 60-40 or 70-30 with more stocks than bonds in it. And yeah, like rebalancing does reduce your returns because it does reduce the proportion of fast growing things in it. But I guess it's you're doing it for the same reason as you initially decided that you wanted to have 50-50. You know what? So it's that initial 50-50 decision is the thing that counts. You can always dial up your returns by you know, going to 70-30, 80-20, but you'd be taking more risk along with it. So it's sort of a question of how much risk do you want to tolerate. Now, like, okay, you're talking about that it cuts out your winners. There's probably a little something to that, you know, stocks and assets, they do exhibit a kind of a momentum. Stuff that's been going up tends to keep going up. So, you know, by selling it off, you're kind of lessening the momentum, momentum effect, and the momentum is another one of these tailwinds that you get. But it's the price. If you want to keep the risk down, you have to keep the risk down.
Sean, do you invest? And if so, what do you invest in?
I invest in dumb, boring index funds. You know, I've had my day as a full-time investor, with the newsletters, and it was good. Like they were actually really successful, in their returns, which I was sort of pleasantly surprised by. But I think it was the time and place in the market in which I found myself. You know, the theme was small caps and technology, And the time when it was launched was, I think it was 2015, middle of 2015. So 2015 to 2018, 2019, great time to be doing that. So I had a lot of fun, like, coming up with a strategy, or copying a strategy, basically, is what I did, which, but it seemed, you know, copying a strategy, implementing it, finding the companies, telling the story, all of that. But it's a lot of work. And also, I couldn't stop the nagging feeling that I was just lucky. And I know I'm not going to devote the amount of time to my investments as I did before. That's a full-time job. And I'm happy enough to just have my index funds diversified, got some factors in there, got some different exposure to different markets. And I think that's all I need. It's not fun for me.
What was that quote? I think it was Napoleon or something said, I'd rather have a lucky commander than a brilliant one.
Yes, I think.
Anyway, what has
the former category.
So what has been your best investment so far and your worst investing mistake?
My best investment was definitely this company called Blue Prism. I was fantastically fortunate with that one. It was a company, it happened to be in my little zone of, UK listed, and I was looking for, the strategy I was running was sort of, it was small cap quality I was going for. So I wasn't paying, what I basically meant in practice was that I was buying small caps and like it kind of almost ignoring price, like, which is sort of counterintuitive and very few investors would admit to that. But I think that's when I think about it, that's what I was doing. I was prioritizing companies that had the right quality characteristics that were small. And I wasn't getting too upset if they were expensive. And Blue Prism anyway, sorry. And also the UK stock market AIM doesn't get a lot of great companies, especially a lot of great technology companies. So there's rare that one turns up. But anyway, one did turn up. It listed in sometime in 2016, I think. And I heard an interview that there was a sort of an LSE had these great podcasts, they do these like talks at lunchtime in the LSE, and then they record them and then they broadcast them. There is someone talking about automation and robotic process automation and as a kind of a great new technology. And Blue Prism, this newly listed company, happened to be doing exactly that. So I was like, okay, that's very interesting. I know I've got a bit of a head start. I know a bit more about this one. I'll buy it and I'll stick it in the portfolio. And oh God, I think it was up. Did it read? I think it went over 20x. So that's over 2000%. But in a kind of a 3-year period, then it fell back and it was eventually acquired. It was acquired at like 15x or something like that. So I didn't get the full value out of it, or the subscribers didn't get the full value out of it. But that was brilliant.
Fab, nice result.
Yeah, that was the big one. And my biggest investing mistake was, I guess being honest, I made the classic mistake of not thinking as hard about my selling decisions as my buying decisions. And I guess it was a sort of a feature of the newsletter that you're kind of always, you had to produce this sort of 10 page report every month on a new company. So there was a lot of work in that, finding the company, interviewing the people, producing the report. So you're kind of structurally, your attention was there, but then like, I wasn't really right way to be doing it at all. Like I had this portfolio with 20 stocks in it, so I needed to be constantly repricing that. And so like, as I said, it was a bull market. Stuff was going up. I was delighted to see it, but there was a few of those big winners that I could have taken money off the table at the top and subsequently fell back a bit. I mean, it worked out fine in the end on average and over time, but definitely it's harder. It's just more boring to be constantly reassessing your old investment picks than finding new ones. But it's the name of the game. As I talk, I'm just remembering, I saw some paper about this. Literally 5 years ago, I remember reading a paper about it. And it was something to the effect that, like, professional investors, like, are terrible at this also. They are good at picking stocks and rubbish at selling them and at the right time. I'll have to dig it out and maybe write about it in the newsletter. But yeah, that would be my words of wisdom. Put as much effort into your existing investments as your new ones.
Yeah, I think all investing mistakes always lead to a sell decision. Like I have yet to interview anybody when I asked them, what's your worst investing mistake, where the word sell doesn't come into it, or in fact, it was an absolute moment where they sold. I mean, I've said it before on the podcast, but I rebalanced my portfolio over the years and sold what today would be worth $1 million worth of Netflix for like 30 grand. I did probably the same in Tesla. And had I just sat still and left it forever, I certainly would have a different wealth profile to the one I have today. That said, it informs and we move forward. And, you know, there's no mistakes. There's just lessons. So, Sean, what type of investments are you looking
for? If you do rebalance, it's impossible to become a millionaire from investing. You know, you have to, it's either one or the other. There's no way to both rebalance and to get rich.
Couldn't agree more. I could not agree more. And with the weight of real data in my investing life, I had a data scientist intern about a year ago, maybe a year and a half ago. I gave him full untethered access to all my brokerages and every decision I made. And he analyzed, I think it was 19 years of buys and sells that I made in my online brokerage, my TD Ameritrade brokerage, which is my largest one, almost my original one. And there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that when you buy something, you should put 99% of your effort in before a buy and then spend the last 1% of effort watching it and giving it decades to fulfill its strategic purpose. Because businesses, they hit the rocks. Macroeconomics weighs down on businesses very heavily. I mean, you know, there was, I think it was a 17-year period that you would have been down on a purchase an Apple. And of course, I've cherry-picked the most extreme positive example, and how it worked out clearly is there for all to see. But like when I look at other businesses, really, if you're getting in, sit with it. And Warren Buffett says, don't buy a stock unless you're treating it like you would a marriage. You go in, you buy it, and you sit on it for a very long term.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Moving on, Sean, what type of investments are you looking at for the next few years, if any?
As I've been writing in the email, like I came into this whole world of investment in about 11 years ago, something like that. And I was like quite close to ordinary investors because I was like, they're subscribing to our newsletter. So I kind of knew exactly what they were interested in and what they weren't interested in and what they wanted to read about. And value at the time was like overwhelmingly like the answer, especially among investors who took themselves seriously, private investors who were quite serious about what they were doing. And over time, like that just winnowed, natural attrition and Darwin, you know, natural selection winnowed those people away. The newsletters all withered away because value just didn't work for between 2009 on for 10 years after 2009. And the guys who stuck to it were sort of, you know, value investors are by their nature contrarian and kind of maybe their personality is a bit kind of grumpy or something. You know, they're kind of, they do things their own way. That's like, that's the personality. That fits it. But the guys, like, they sort of seemed stubborn, you know, they stuck at it regardless of, in the face of the evidence, it wasn't working year after year after year after year, and they were sticking at it and it just wasn't working. And I then found myself as the investor of like the opposite side of the fence. So I was like technology stocks and growth stocks in a bull market, you know. But if you, yeah, it just in the last few years, the gap between growth and value had just got so extreme, so historically unprecedentedly extreme, that it did seem to me that it would be the right time to make the move back. And it's kind of started to happen, I think. I wrote about it yesterday. Like, it's what happens is, like, when the academics who study the value factor, they're not looking necessarily at just, like, you know, value stocks, like an undervalued utility or something like that. They're looking at the cheapest stocks minus the most expensive stocks. So they're long cheap and short expensive. And the difference between those two is the value factor, as understood by academics.
Yeah.
So what's happening is, like, the value factor as understood by academics has dramatically turned around. And it's doing brilliantly for the last, it's August now, 18 months or something like that. But if you just looked at, like, a value index maybe, or value stocks, which are long only, that's been middling. It's done better than others, but it's still not done great. But, like, it's what's the point is that the value factor has done well, because it's all of these incredibly overpriced, expensive stocks, the likes of the Cathie Wood stocks. That's how I think of them. All the Cathie Wood stocks have just given up altogether. The value factor is short all those crazy, crazy expensive stocks. Now the question is, like, that's a shift that started to happen. The dumb value, sorry, the dumb growth is definitely out of fashion. The question is, like, is it the beginning of a process that leads into the return of value and of, like, the long leg of that trade, long value? So that's where I'd be looking. That's where I'd be positioning myself. I think, and there's other sides of it, like, that make me think value could be in a well positioned, apart from just the fact that it's beginning to happen. The other is value does better at times of higher interest rates. Because of the mechanics of it, like, value is more about the present moment than, like, the future. So higher interest rates are better for that. And also value is a bit better when inflation is high, and inflation is obviously going up. So, yeah, I think...
So the investments you're looking at in the next few years are value stocks?
Yeah, in a nutshell.
And are you putting the... Is there a fund that you're actually watching? Like, is there a value fund that you are investing in? Because I know from what you said earlier, you're more of an ETF or a fund person.
Yeah, like the latter. I mean, it's can be tricky for retail investors to get into, because as I said, you can value indexes or value ETFs. They are mostly long only.
Yeah.
So you're not getting that full benefit. Like, fancier funds, like your AQRs do funds that are, like, more systematically exposed to the value factor, which are long and short. I guess the point is that the easily accessible retail value funds, they haven't perked up yet. Based on the kind of preview we're getting in the value factor, I suspect that those guys are looking well positioned.
Sean, time to brush off your crystal ball and make a wild prediction on where the economy, which, let's say for the purpose of this conversation, is the S&P 500, where will it be in 6 months, 12 months, and in 3 years from now?
I think, yeah, the distinction between the S&P 500 and the economy is important here, because we're definitely like the US and the and Europe are really decoupling in a way that is even more than has in the last 10 years. The US, the difference between the US and the EU, obviously, inflation is lower in the US, or sorry, it's, maybe it's not actually lower, but it's easier to contain because the US is energy independent. And, you know, basically the Fed has all the tools it needs to get inflation in order there. And I've every confidence that in the US, the Fed will do that. It's not like it's not that hard for a determined central bank to control inflation. Will it result in a hard landing? I've read a lot about this and I've listened to a lot of podcasts about this, but I genuinely don't know. It's very hard to get to gauge that. I think my basic feeling is that the S&P 500 is, and that's where most of my investments are. It is the right place to be. You've got this sort of funny situation in the States with like very low unemployment, like reasonably high growth, but they just have this inflation problem. And I think, you know, you've got a central bank that has in the past been determined to minimize unemployment, and it's gone much further than its like predecessors in minimizing unemployment under Powell. So I don't think they're not the type of central bank that's sort of like single-mindedly hawkish and myopic and determined to crush inflation at all costs. I don't think that's the mindset of that group. But at the same time, like I think they've belatedly woken up to the inflation problem, and they're going to do what it takes to get it out of the system. So yeah, I mean, as I always tend to put a lot of emphasis on what the central bank wants and what the central bank, how united it is, and I think this Powell central bank strikes me as a good setup, and I think with them in charge, you're not going to go too far wrong with the S&P in the US.
Mm. Good. Well, I hope you're right. What do you see as the biggest macro threat over the next 12 months to the economic systems that you're looking at?
Oh, I mean, it's kind of, I won't say terrifying is too strong a word, but it's like more scary than I've seen in a long time. Like the whole energy, like the European setup is quite worrying. Like to have such high, so Europe is different from the US. I just don't know how the energy and inflation thing is going to play out in Europe. Also the ECB is a sort of a myopic central bank. Much more than the US, it is more likely to come down hard on inflation, and Europe's economy is weaker to the extent that you can be pretty sure that interest rate rises to control inflation in Europe are probably going to result in a recession here. So that's like, yeah, like we know they're going to have to hit the brakes so hard that it probably results in a recession. And then we've got long running energy problems like that won't be resolved probably this year. You know, they might take several years to fix. So you just have this like, you know, it's like an unusual situation. You know, I'm not used to it. I've only been around for 10 or 11 years. I haven't, in the professional sense, I've never had a situation where you've got this like genuine supply side constraint and you've got problems that can't be solved by, you know, more monetary expansion or whatever it is. All the monetary expansion has been used up and we're still going to have a recession, and, you know, we're just going to have to do the very slow, patient work of like, rewiring, I suppose, our entire energy system, and that's going to take time. I don't know. I'm sort of worried about Europe.
Yeah, interesting. So would that imply, Sean, that the dollar will US dollar will remain strong, and in turn that will continue to hurt American multinationals that report in dollars?
I suppose it would. Yeah. I mean, to be honest, now I've always wondered how on earth traders trade currencies. Because it just seems so like big, you know, like how, like you're trying to price the productive capacity of a, whatever, 20 trillion economy versus another $20 trillion economy, and there's so many moving parts. I don't know where they get their numbers. I don't understand how currency people go long and short.
Yeah, what they you do. Me both. I've looked at it, and I have to say it's like black art. I really am with you. It is so difficult to actually assimilate the information you're getting and understand how it's going to influence how two exchanges, our exchange rates are influenced. It's very, very difficult. And I have another angle, I suppose, Sean, which is all these student loan forgiveness things that are happening in the United States most recently, will they result in more money flowing into consumer spending in the coming quarters and years? So Biden has forgiven, I think it's $10,000 worth of student debt. I think is if you earn less than $150,000, I think up to $20,000 if you're in another bracket. The way I'm looking at that is that means more money will flow into retail.
Yeah, like you would have thought so. I mean, the textbooks would say it would. Like we've gotten away with doing stuff like that for the last 15 years because we've sort of had the economy has been underemployed. So there was there was win-win scenarios everywhere. You know, you could, you know, the government could borrow money cheaply and spend it and it would be a net win. The central bank could print money and push it out into the financial system. That would be a net win. And, you know, the government could cut taxes or forgive student debt, and that would be a net win. It would all result in more employment and better outcomes for everybody. But now we are in the more difficult world where you actually have like trade-offs, and if you want to make the place more prosperous, you can't just spend more money. You have to do things more efficiently and get more with less. So that's the kind of, I think that'll be challenging for politicians and everybody to get their head around. Like, you know, it took politicians a long time to figure out that it was a good idea to print and spend and be more expansionary, and I worry it'll take them a long time to figure out that it's now a bad idea to be more expansionary. They will still continue applying the types of remedies that were appropriate in 2015 and 2025. So as for student debt, you know, obviously that's the particulars of that. I wouldn't like to be an American saddled with a whole bunch of student debt, so I'm sure they're very happy about it. But like the macroeconomics of it aren't great. And it's the kind of thing I suspect we'll probably see more of in different countries around the world.
Okay, let's close with a quick round of buy, sell or hold. So all the questions I'm about to ask you relate to a 5-year holding period, and you only have to say buy, sell or hold. Okay.
Sure.
Would you buy, sell or hold office space in Manhattan?
I would. Okay, without knowing, I mean, it's difficult to say this without knowing the pricing of office space in Manhattan, obviously, and, you know, yields and so on. But let's shoot from the hip and say sell, because I have been looking at, there's a guy called Nick Bloom, who's an economist. He's been collecting survey data on people's working habits, you know, working from home over the last couple of years. And in the States, you find like that working from home has sort of settled in now at about 2 or 3 days a week. And it's sort of been quite stable at that level. Similarly, employers, the bosses, their expectations of how much people should work from home are like going up and up and up and up. And they're kind of converging with what workers want. So it'll be hard to shift that pattern. You know, people, the longer it goes on, the more people get used to it, the more they plan their lives around working from home. And it'll take many years for companies to kind of work it through in terms of like figuring out how it affects their productivity, figuring out even if they wanted to get employees back, whether it's possible to get them back, to make them come back, figuring out what's the best way to rationalize their office space given the new demand, all of that. So it seems like it'll take many years to all play out. But like, yeah, in a world of 40% or 30% less people in the office each day, you'd have to imagine that a lot of office space is going to be sublet and maybe repurposed in new ways. I mean, I'm sure like Manhattan itself will continue to be really busy and really awesome, but maybe just the composition will change. Maybe there'll be fewer office workers and more other people, other interesting people.
Buy, sell, or hold Bitcoin?
I'm not a Bitcoin guy, and I've like spectacularly missed everything with Bitcoin. So, you know, take what I say with a pinch of salt. But I do think it might actually, I'm gonna say it might be a buy now, because it's sort of in its trough. I saw a chart that Noah Smith did. It was like a log chart of Bitcoin's rises and falls, and when you see it expressed in a log pattern, there is a sort of striking kind of clarity to it. It's like it hits its peak, has it gives back 70% of its gains, new peak 70% of its gains, new peak 70% of its gains. I think it might have one more bubble left in it. Another thing about Bitcoin is each subsequent bubble or each subsequent peak is much, the gains are much smaller than the previous one. So from peak to peak, it kind of, the gains have lessened over time. So if you were buying it, if you bought the last peak, if it does do it again and it holds this pattern, you might expect to kind of double your money. But if you do manage to get lucky and buy in the bottom and in the trough, if now is the trough, and if it does hold to its long-term pattern and it does have one more bubble in it, then you do very well. You might make, you know, whatever, 10 times your money or something like that. So I'll speculatively call it a yes. Goodbye.
Buy, sell, or hold the S&P 500.
Well, I'm very much long the S&P 500. Yeah, the S&P 500 is great. It's just the best thing ever for ordinary people. Everyone should have it.
Buy, sell, or hold art?
I sell. It's just too weird. I don't trust it. All this, like all the stuff we talked about the equity risk premium and the way you make money from securities by dealing with volatility and all that. Like, it doesn't. That makes sense to me. It's intuitive and it's like a framework. Whereas art, I don't know, just seems like a kind of a bet on, is it kind of like a bet on inequality or something? It's like a bet on the amount of disposable income of the top 1%. Maybe that makes it a good bet, but I don't know.
Well, it's priced boring. Inefficiently. Like it's a function. Yeah. You're right. It's a function of a very, very limited set of buyers, you know? But anyway, let's not go there. Look, Sean, finally, if you could only own one asset for the rest of your life, what would it be?
Ah, good old S&P 500. Sorry, I know I'm so bored. I mean, like, yeah, there's another interesting one was like, in the long run, there's a paper called like the investment returns on everything, like from 1860 to the present day or something like that. And these are historian researchers managed to stitch together this data set out of like God knows where they got all their data, but it had real estate and bonds and stocks and whatever else, all sorts of whatever alternatives there were. And what it found was that when you actually manage to get the data together, that like real estate is actually an amazing investment because it matches the returns to stocks, the sort of the tailwind that we're talking about. But that it's much, much less volatile year to year. So, you know, the rents from a property are pretty stable. You get that stability. You can plan your life around it, and you don't have to have that like kind of anxiety and heartburn that your house is worth half of what it was or double what it was. But that in the long run, since 1860. The overall returns have matched that of stocks. So yeah, housing is interesting, but then obviously it's complicated. There's all these tax matters and regulatory matters, and in Ireland in particular, it seems it's more challenging than in most places. But it's worth look, digging that paper up. It's like it's worth digging that paper up on just what it is that makes assets worth owning in the first place.
Sean, thank you very much for joining me today. How can our listeners get to read your weekly newsletter?
Okay, they can. The easiest way is to follow me on Twitter. My handle thing is @Keyes, KEYES. And right there at the top of my Twitter bio is a link to sign up to the investment newsletter. And you can find the currency from that too, and you can take out a trial subscription if that floats your boat.
Fantastic. Sean, thank you very much for joining me this morning. Looking forward to reading more of your newsletters in the months and years ahead.
Thanks, Emmett. Enjoyed it.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com. The number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.